to boil it down, basically gave them that assurance concretely, you will not be scoped in.
Yeah.
And Heritage Minister Pablo Rodriguez said, no thanks. He rejected your amendment. And now I read in the Globe and Mail, Heritage Minister rejects key C-11 amendment, puts himself on potential collision course with senators. Oh my goodness, you're on a collision course with Pablo. Senator Simons, what is that collision going to look like? What's going to happen now?
Well, I think this is not monster trucks. The Senate suggested 26 amendments. 18 of them have been accepted in whole or in part. That's quite a lot, including, you know, a number of other amendments that I proposed. So I'm happy that my other amendments were accepted. The Senate's role is not to defeat legislation just because we don't like it. It's not even to say, you know, this is bad and we could have done a better job. We defeat legislation when it's prima facie unconstitutional. So if this legislation really was the grotesque violation of free speech that a certain corner of the internet would have you believe, then it would be our bounden responsibility to defeat it. I just think it's bad legislation. So we've made it better. 18 solid amendments were accepted. A couple of them were extremely important. And so I'm glad to see the government has accepted those amendments. At the end of the day, though, I don't think it's not going to be a collision so much as a drive-by yelling out the window.
I think I got an answer there. It would be like a pretty radical. It would be pretty uncommon, but you could defeat this, but you're not going to.
Sure. Hypothetically, but we're not going to. You know, I mean, I don't think I've publicly said how I'm going to vote yet. I think I've been kind of hedgy about it because I still need to listen to the debate in the chamber. You don't like to, you know, want to lay all your cards on the table. But let's just say I would need to be really convinced to change my mind to vote in favor of this bill. But I think for most other senators, they will look and say, okay, 18 amendments were accepted. Amendments were accepted from every single group in the Senate, including the conservatives. There are some really important changes that got made, including one amendment I'm very proud of, which was that there was a part of the bill that gave the cabinet the power to intervene in all kinds of CRTC decision making. And we heard from a number of dispassionate experts who passionately said that this is a very bad idea. And so I put forward the premise that we should simply delete that entire section of the bill. And to my surprise and my pleasure, the government has agreed. It was bad legislative drafting, and that entire section is now gone. So I don't want to say that the Senate's work went unheard. We heard from 137 witnesses. We had months of hearings. The government has accepted key and critical amendments around privacy protection, around freedom of speech, and around the independence of the CRTC. So this amendment that they have rejected, I'm extremely disappointed. I think the government is making a bad strategic decision, and I think this is going to have negative consequences. I don't think that there are enough people in the Senate who are incensed enough that we could defeat the bill on that basis. I mean, we don't have to defeat the bill outright. We could insist on that amendment and send it back.
Are you going to do that?
Well, there's no we.
You have your vote.
I have my vote. And remember, outside the Conservative caucus, every other, and there are about 16 members of the Conservative caucus now, every other senator is an independent. No senator is whipped. No senator votes to order. We each make our own independent decisions. So I cannot tell you what the Senate is going to do. I can't even tell you what the independent senators group to which I belong is going to do. I can tell you what I'm going to do. And in fact, I'm not even telling you that, am I?
Not yet. You're not going to send that amendment back?
I mean, in order to send the amendment back, we would need to have the consensus of the Senate. I am one voice, one loud, oh so articulate voice, but...
And what will that loud, articulate voice say?
I'm writing the speech, you know, just before we began our conversation, I've been putting the finishing touches on my Bill C-11 message speech, which I hope to give next week.
Oh, it's a Senate secret. It's a senator secret.
It's a senator secret. I mean, you know, I want to be fair to the government here, because as I say, they did accept. I mean, they made substantive compromises to this bill.
Why did they throw this one out? Why, like, if they insisted again and again that there's lies and innuendo about this bill, it's not going to capture YouTubers, it's not. And then you said, okay, let's just put that in there. And they said, no, we're not putting that in there. So why?
That's a very good question. I don't think to put back on my hat as a political analyst, which I used to be for a living, I have the impression that there was not unanimity of opinion within the Liberal caucus.
Senator, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for making me feel that my work is futile and meaningless. And like Sisyphus, however, I will continue to push the rock up the hill, and I will continue to do what I always did as a columnist, which is to make trouble.
We miss you in journalism, but I know you're doing what you can where you are. That's your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadaland.com. Tristan Capicchione is our audio editor and technical producer. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Sean Silkoff, business writer for the Globe and Mail. Hello.
Hi, Jesse.
Today on the show, dude, where's my judge? Sean, welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news.
Thanks for having me.
Tonight, what the police report reveals about a confrontation involving a Canadian Supreme Court judge. The incident, the interviews, and the call to 911.
Sean, how about those Supreme Court judges of Canada? What do you think?
I think there's nine of them, but one of them isn't working right now.
You got it. We got nine of them. And all nine wear fluffy red Santa robes. If you line them up in a row, it's adorable. It's a snuggly little collection. But what happens if one Supreme Court justice goes missing? If a Supreme Court justice goes missing in Canada, does it make a sound? Do we notice? Let me tell you a story. It begins in February, when Justice Russell Brown, who was appointed by former Prime Minister Stephen Harper, he disappeared. He stopped showing up for work. Turns out he took a leave of absence, but at the time, nobody knew that. It was like, I guess, a secret leave of absence at the time. Nothing was said publicly. The court did not provide any reason for this. Could have been anything. Chief Justice Richard Wagner informed Federal Justice Minister David Lametti that Justice Brown was on a leave of absence, and the Justice Minister didn't say anything either. The first clue came in a court ruling a few weeks later when an asterisk was placed next to Justice Brown's name explaining that he had not participated in this ruling. He had participated in the hearing that led to the ruling, but not to the ruling. That's all the public saw. But a keen-eyed reporter, your colleague at the Globe and Mail, Justice reporter Sean Fine, noticed that asterisk and sent some questions to the court, essentially asking, dude, where's my judge? And it was relevant because there was a big environmental law case coming up, which was going to pit like federal jurisdiction against provincial, and Justice Brown tends to have dissenting opinions in favor of provincial jurisdiction. This was going to be a consequential absence if he wasn't around for it. So, you know, what was he going to be there? Where is he? What's the deal? And only because Sean Fine asked that question did we get some partial information. The court released the statement. Stephanie Bachand, executive legal officer to the Chief Justice, sent an email. Unfortunately, we cannot disclose why Justice Brown is currently on leave to respect confidentiality. There has been no statement by the court for the same reason. Very mysterious. So now at least the question is out there and the press is buzzing around trying to figure out like what's going on here. And ultimately we're told he's on a leave of absence. Okay, this is when we find out he's on a leave of absence, but we don't know why. On February 27th, the CBC gets a quote from Amir Adaran, law professor at University of Ottawa, who's been on the show before. And this is what you do when you can't actually report facts to the news. You get experts' opinion. You kind of put pressure on it. Adaran says, like, this is strange. He says, listen, If Justice Brown is absent for personal reasons because he's ill or caring for a family member, then okay, then there's a right to confidence. But if it's for workplace reasons, if he's been throwing furniture in the office or harassing coworkers, then that's not rightly confidential. He's a public official, and we should at least be told whether it's due to personal or workplace reasons. That is when we got the statement from the Canadian Judicial Council on March 7th.
We have a developing story today. A Supreme Court of Canada justice is under investigation. The Canadian Judicial Council says it is reviewing a complaint into the alleged conduct of Russell Brown.
His conduct is being reviewed because of a complaint. Okay, now you've got reporters really interested. And it was the Vancouver Sun's Ian Mulgrew who got the story first. And it ran on March 9th. Here's what we learned through that report and through some reporting from the Globe and Mail. The headline read, High Court Justice Russell Brown under investigation after altercation at Arizona Resort. What? The country's judicial watchdog is investigating accusations that Supreme Court of Canada Justice Russell Brown engaged in obnoxious, drunken conduct in Arizona that ended in an altercation, Post Media has learned. Here's the story as I've been able to piece together from a bunch of different reports. Pretty detailed, actually. So Justice Russell Brown was in Arizona. He was at the Omni Scottsdale Resort and Spa on January 28th. He was there for an awards ceremony and banquet honoring Louise Arbour, former Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada. And according to one of the women involved in this incident, she was at the resort too with her friends. There was this group of people who were there for a different thing, for a baby shower. And they were at the lounge at like 11 p.m. And it was this woman and her mom, and one of them had a boyfriend there too. And the boyfriend goes to the bathroom or something, and it's just the three women at the lounge. And one of them sees Judge Brown. She'd noticed him earlier in the bar wearing a tuxedo. I thought he was part of a wedding, she said. So I invited him over because I thought he was just like, yeah, you know, we're all hanging out. Come hang out with us. So he joins them while the boyfriend is in the bathroom. The boyfriend comes back and finds this judge in a tuxedo with his girlfriend and the other ladies. And this boyfriend, who happens to be a Marine Corps veteran named John Crump, he says that Brown boasted of his importance and began to read from his speech. One of the ladies present told police later that the judge kissed her on the cheek once or twice, placed his hand on the small of her back, touched her leg. She says to the police that, you know, she wasn't touched in a sexual way, but it was unwanted touching. So the Marine says that later on, they're getting away from this guy. One of the ladies said that, you know, he was coming on to me while he was touching my daughter. It was super creepy. And this is a sordid little story, Sean, and I'm going to tell you every little detail of it. So according to these witnesses, the judge follows them as they go back to their room. And this Marine veteran blocks the guy and tells police that he says to the judge, look, you are clearly intoxicated. The girls are creeped out by you. And the judge shoved him. I pushed him back, says Crump, and then I punched him in the face twice, and he fell to the ground. An official with the resort later told the cops that he found Justice Brown by the hotel pool and went back to his room without any fuss. And all three of these people involved gave these lengthy statements. Video from the body cam on the cop went public, and the police report is in the hands of the Canadian press right now. And as the story trickles out, Justice Brown breaks his silence and denies it all. He says, we all left the lounge at roughly the same time. Outside of the lounge, Mr. Crump objected to me rejoining the group and suddenly, without warning or provocation, punched me several times in the head. Taken by surprise, I was unable to defend myself. And he said that he'd hoped to keep his silence on this, but because the Marine went public, it forced him to make a statement. Sean, what do you make of this story from Arizona?
Well, the facts are still coming out. I'm just an armchair observer like anyone. A couple of things jump out. Humanity is messy. Things happen that are complex, and sometimes people should take a hint. If it's true that he was reading from his speech to a bunch of people in a bar, that's not someone I want to hang out with at a bar. But, you know, that's his right, I would suppose. You said this was a sordid little story. You know, the most sordid thing about this is kind of the way that the keepers of information in Canada, official information, the Judicial Council and so on and so forth, didn't share any of this with the public. I find that kind of disturbing. If he's under investigation, if he's suspended or not at his job, in a very, very important job in Canadian civil society, we need to know that, and we need to know why. And I think this is kind of a pattern in Canada where a lot of stuff that should be shared with the public, with the press, isn't. And we have to go to exceptional lengths in the press to get it out there. You know, if you've ever used the access to information system, as I know you probably have, you know how deeply frustrating it can be, how you can wait months or years for even basic information, which is often heavily redacted. There's very little data where there should be lots of data. And this isn't a good thing. It's not a good thing for anyone in Canada. So that's one of the things that jumps out at me. I think as Canadians, the thing that disturbs me the most is how it took a lot of pressing to get these details out when they should have just been readily and freely offered to the public.
I think you got it. I mean, as for the story itself, who the hell knows? It's of moderate, mild, prurient interest. The thing that's really alarming here is exactly what you're talking about, that like if a Supreme Court judge from the States just like went missing, like was not at work for week after week, there would be like a hue and cry. And I'm not going to put this on our press because without Sean Fine asking that question, without Ian Mulgrew getting the information, like it's the press that actually brought this to our attention. But it was like 5 weeks went by. And it wasn't even like that scandalous a story. Like obviously calculations had been made that like this is such a stain and a smear on the prestige of the court that we can't even let the public know that these allegations have been made or even that there's an investigation or a complaint has been filed. Like it was all just kept under lock and key. When Glenn McGregor posted the body cam video.
Are you who called us?
Yeah, yeah. I was the one who called.
How can I help you?
So some guy was trying to roll up on the girls that I was with. Followed us back from the bar, back to the room. I told him, you're not following us. Basically, he tried to get around me. I said, you're not following the girls to the room at all. I shoved him. He came back at me, kind of fought him a little bit. He ripped my shirt, and then hotel staff helped him back to his room.
He remarked on Twitter, amazing how much more transparent the U.S. justice system is compared to Canada's. The police sent us this video within hours of our request. Sean, don't you like breathe a sigh of relief when you're trying to report a story that starts in Canada, but then the story somehow moves to the States because you just know you're going to get so much more information? Like any institution, like police, official bodies, governments, or even just eyewitnesses, like you get the story from three different perspectives. You get video footage. You get a police report. Like it is like pulling teeth to get anything in Canada.
Well, certainly when you're dealing with U.S. institutions, it is like breathing different air and the information tends to flow a little more freely. Sometimes it's kind of funny. I think it makes for better reporters in Canada because we're just used to and assume that it'll be harder to get the information out here. So we go to other lengths. I mean, we call our sources, we do our homework, et cetera. One thinks it really shouldn't be that hard to get some of this basic information out. You can agree, well, okay, maybe the court didn't have to spill everything or the judge's counsel, but it shouldn't have been so hard to pry some basic details out of them as it was. We're kind of used to it here. It's unfortunate. Occasionally we publish big stories. The Globe has done this about how hard it is to get data out of official institutions in Canada, how people don't talk. I mean, just look at the reporting out of Ottawa from our bureau and in particular and others about how difficult it is to pry information and so on out of the government. I mean, even this government promised to improve the access to information system, but I don't know if you've used it recently.
Yeah.
I guess that priority kind of fell into the back of the couch along with proportional representation and spare quarters out of people's pockets.
It's just a daily thing here. I mean, David Pugliese reporting for the Ottawa Citizen on this very important story, much more important story, I would say, about sexual misconduct allegations against Canada's top soldier. Department of Defense, he reports, claimed that a document about this couldn't be found. Then we told them we had it. Essentially, there's a suggestion here that they were misrepresenting the fact. Like, it's one thing if they don't give you documents in a timely manner or they withhold things. They'll actually claim they don't have it. And there's a long history of documents being destroyed or, you know, I don't want to say lie without, you know, but like where we later find out that things that they say they don't have, they had all the time. You know, this is a problem for reporting at like a fundamental level. It is a big, I guess, cultural, like institutional culture difference. Like it's almost like withhold by default is how it works here in Canada. You know, Stephen Harper's government's got like a lot of attention for how withholding they were and how broken the system was for ATIP. I don't think that the current government is any better. And with all of the rhetoric that we get about like the importance of the press, they're going to support the press, they're going to bail out the press is so important. I'm like, you want to help us answer our questions, like hand over the documents which you're legally required to give us when we ask for them. That would be a good start. Sean, it is your first time on Shortcuts, and you may not know that we cannot stand it. We can't abide for an important news story or tidbit of information to whiz past people. We won't stand for that. Instead, we duly note it. Sean, do you have something to duly note?
I do. It's a little self-serving.
I encourage it.
Well, yesterday, the trailer for the new film Blackberry dropped online, and it's based on a book that I co-wrote with Jackie McNish called Losing the Signal, about the rise and fall of Blackberry. The movie's coming out across North America. See the movie, read the book.
Check it out. I'm excited for this movie. Will you come on the show and talk to me about your reporting on Blackberry?
I will.
Duly noted. I've got a quick tidbit to duly note here. A group called Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East has announced that they have a project called the Media Accountability Project, created to encourage Canadian media to provide professional and fair-minded coverage of the Middle East, especially Palestine, Israel. I think this is essentially a group that advocates for Palestine, and they are launching this media monitoring effort. And I want to duly note this. I like this, because it's better than what we have right now. Right now, we just have one media watchdog group that I'm aware of anyhow that is specifically focused on Middle East coverage. And that is the pro-Israel group Honest Reporting. Nothing per se against Honest Reporting, except for like the effect of what happens because they're there. And there's nothing wrong with what they're doing. Anybody can do what they're doing. It's just that like they will read or watch or listen to everything that the Canadian media puts out on Israel. They read it very closely, and then their job is to complain if they, in their estimation, think that it's anti-Israel or biased or anti-Semitic in any way. But they define anti-Semitism in a very Israel-focused kind of way. And again, I think that's fine. You can do that, and then you can complain. And those complaints do make an impact. They make an impact for very like basic and straightforward reasons, like reporters don't like when groups complain about their work or go to your boss and complain about your coverage. And you think about that when you're covering Israel, that there is this group watching very closely. And from that, they get, I guess, a lot more consideration from their point of view in coverage. But the knock-on effect of that is that I think it perpetuates this rather racist myth that Jews control the media. And I always think like, man, if people only knew, Jews don't control the media. A few Jewish people at this one special interest group that do not represent a lot of Jewish people, this group is paid to read the media every day and then complain. It's very simple. So now, with this new group doing that from the other point of view, any reporter on the Middle East beat, and man, I do not want that beat, they will now have to worry about getting complaints from either of these two groups, which is stressful. But I would suggest it is a better framework for coverage than how it has been thus far.
Duly noted.
Sean, that is Shortcuts. Thank you for joining me for it.
Hey, Jesse, thanks. That was fun.
Listen, we're on Twitter at CanadaLand. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com, and I read everything that you send. Sean Silkoff, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm everywhere you'd expect to find me.
And a movie based on your book and reporting, Blackberry, is out soon. This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard, with additional production by Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofor. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Look.